So the most important concepts that we want to say is at year end, there are some very important tax planning strategies that you can take advantage of that just end. And each year, they're non-accretive or non-accruing. So if you don't do them by year end, you get to do them maybe in the new year, but maybe not. You may get to do them again in the new year, but you lost the opportunity to do them in the previous year. So we'll talk about that. The second thing that is important is that, and I use this quote in the office, if you do this work now, this year, maybe next year the same opportunity to make the plan won't be valid. It's what I call getting inside the castle walls before the arrows start being flung. And this is an important piece because we know that Congress passes rules. Historically, when clients ask us, do they pass them retroactive? And the answer almost all the time is no. But we have seen instances when they have been retroactive. And what would be horrible is if we put a plan together for you on certain of these strategies in January, and it turned out that in February something was passed and they made it retroactive, that somehow this could potentially deprive you of a great plan in estate planning. So we want you to take advantage of it here. Just the last piece on that is we have never seen the feds pass a law that's retroactive prior to the beginning of any given year. So if they did it in December, probably if they did it in June, it would be retroactive back to the prior January. They did it in March, back to the prior January. If they did it in February, back to the prior January. But they would not make something in March retroactive to the prior year. So we think that the getting is good right now for plans that currently exist. Okay, so first thing that we want to focus on is considering putting gifts to making gifts into trust for your children. There has been a phenomenal strategy, and our clients at more modest means to those that are at the most ultra-affluent range find, and that is to make gifts to a trust where, because of certain provisions in the trust, certain flexible provisions, the IRS allows us to have the gift giver the ability to also pay the income tax on the trust, and that's called making that trust a grantor trust. Some others call it a defective grantor trust. Once you create that trust, it means that as money in the trust continues to grow and compound, the tax responsibility on that trust historically was borne by the trust. So if the trust had $100,000 in it and it gained $20,000 in a very good year in the market, well, then the trust would pay back maybe 30% of that $20,000 or $6,000 to the IRS. Today, a well-drafted trust, a grantor trust, can say the $6,000 can be picked up by mom and dad. So if you have $5 million or $10 million and you have several hundred thousand dollars in trust for your child, what a great gift you can do by picking up the tax for your child and having the tax be paid and not be treated as a gift for your child. As you might expect, the Obama administration is not happy about this. The Obama administration goes after strategies that they think are strictly benefiting the ultra-affluent. And frankly, this is benefiting the most sophisticated. Whether or not it should be fair that, or even constitutional, that he can favor or disproportionately disadvantage the wealthy versus others, but what he's doing is picking off strategies that have greater advantage for the more wealthy. So a grantor trust is one of those. If you create it this year, and next year they outlaw the ability for the grantor to pay the tax, you will be grandfathered in. And so we want you to consider that strongly. And if you're making gifts to your children or to grandchildren, by creating this trust, you're doing great work anyway for them. And do you need to fund it every year? Absolutely not. So there is no commitment, as in another financial product that you may have, which says each year you have to write checks out. This one you decide what you want to give, or nothing at all. Okay, number two is many of you have created partnerships and LLCs. We've done these to organize your assets. We've done these to find the central located manager of all of your assets. and it is a great giant opportunity to keep centrally located management system. The additional piece is that over time you've said, well, maybe what I'll do is I'll give some fractional piece of my ownership interest to trust for my children. And by the way, the IRS says if you do that, if you appraise it, we can discount the value because the fractional piece your children have is non-controlling. The fractional piece that your children have is illiquid. And so if there is $1 million in a partnership and you give away 10%, that should be equal to $100,000. But guess what? Maybe we can get a reduction down to $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000. So there are good tax reasons, which are not the leading reason the IRS insists, but will still allow it to happen. So we have been doing this for years. The IRS and the Obama administration, again, has been going after this strategy and saying that they no longer want to give deductions on discounted interest because of family-controlled businesses. So number one, if you're looking to create a family partnership as a centrally organized way to manage your assets and then possibly have estate planning strategies behind that, now is the time. Because if they do pass the law, again, we don't believe it will ever be retroactive to December 31st, before December 31st. But number two is the IRS is happily waiting, as I say, like a lion in the tall reeds waiting for the antelope on the open field. And the answer here is they wait for clients like you to say, are you legitimately running your business or this partnership like a business? And what does that mean? Well, they want to know you have legitimate business interests. We help you with that. They want to know that you're running it like a business. We help you that way as well by formalizing it. But the way that they've caught people, and none of you at this point, and if over our dead bodies, would they? But what we want you to do is reach us and catch up because you should have an annual meeting for your partnership. And by that, it means just to say that any legitimate running business, which you have, should have an assessment once a year to assure that it's running the way it should be, to assess the management of it, the performance of the assets inside of it, any change in control or power. And now not only did you create a legitimate business, did you fund it appropriately, did you have the correct legal structure, did you treat it like a business, but now you have the legal evidence of each year doing the annual follow-up. So create the LLCs now if you're considering it, lest you risk being outside the castle walls and vulnerable next year. Number two is those of you who've created them, make sure that you are following up and doing your annual reviews. Number three, are you reporting your gifts properly? This is a big, big issue. Okay, so first piece is if you're writing gifts to your children or your grandchildren, and I can remember 40 years ago my grandfather writing checks out to us each for $1,000 at Christmas time. It was more money than God. All that more money than God went to pay for college. But it looked good when it touched our hands before it went into the accounts. So writing those checks out is all great, and it's a feeling of well-being and goodwill during the holiday season, but have we done planning for you where you've already maximized the gifts you've made? So this can be a little bit complicated. So point number one here is that if you have a life insurance policy that's inside a trust, you know that a portion of your gifts, the premiums that you're paying, are deemed to be gifts to your children and grandchildren, and so that will serve to reduce the gifts that you have made under those policies, and it's a gift that you can give going forward. So if you have two children and your premiums are $50,000 on your policy, well, each child can get $14,000 a year, husband and wife, so that's $28,000. So $28,000 is $52,000. You're still under the maximum amount you can give. But if your premiums are $60,000, then you are $8,000 over. So two issues. One, make sure that you're under your annual exemption amounts with your life insurance premiums. And this is a good time to do it because many people use year-end to pay their premiums on their policies. Number two, if you're under and you want to make gifts to your kids, make sure you do not exceed the annual exemption amount. having a quick call with us to talk about this is very, very important, because we'll review that with you. Number three, this was a discussion that we had several months earlier, and that is GST and generation skipping tax allocations and automatic allocations and exemptions. So when you write a check out to pay your annual insurance premiums, it automatically is allocated to your GST exemption. That may not be what you want to do, because you may say your life insurance is a phenomenal strategy. It pays, which we agree, pays the estate tax, gives liquidity to your children so they're not forced to sell a liquid asset, many other benefits, sense of well-being and comfort in the first immediate months when you pass away. But in the meantime, is it the best use of your generation skipping tax dollars, where you may be using them for assets that are appreciating more? We've had clients in distressed debt funds in Asia and private equity positions that they've wanted to give to their kids that they think are going to explode. And so the point here is that you have a very limited amount of GST exemption. So before you're writing your checks out, or after you write your checks out for your insurance, we do need to look at those insurance trusts and make sure that the premiums that we're paying should be allocated to GST or not. And again, GST is the generation skipping tax. It is a very, very powerful, but also very, very dangerous exemption if it is applied wrongly or to the least advantageous way. We need to talk about it with you. Number four, it's time just to spend a few minutes to review your own estate plan. So there are a few things to keep in mind. For those of you who have left assets in trust to your children, it's been many, many years since we've done it this way, but in the old days, we did allow for distributions a piece at 30, a piece at 35, and a piece at 40. We thought that we were enlightened back then by only having the first distribution at age 30. Of course, there's always money available for the children, always opportunities for education, health, maintaining their quality of life, first home, buying, paying for a wedding, etc. But then the distributions were going out to the children, and at 30, you know, if they got married at 29, and then at 31 they divorced, they were getting this distribution at 30, and surprise, it's now part of their marital estate. So we have moved very quickly to no longer having distributions mandatory. We keep them in trust. We let your children and your other loved ones, we say we let, but we recommend that they keep it in trust and that they serve as their own trustees. If they divorce or they get in a car accident or there's a reversal in their economic life, we know that these assets are protected because they remain inside the trust, number one. Number two, if they pass away, these are not assets that their surviving spouse can attack, which by law they otherwise could. But number two, it passes down to your grandchildren, or if your child has no children, it will go to your child's siblings or nieces and nephews, whomever you want, and it can pass without any generation skipping tax. So if you have a will that either leaves to your children, and now part two here is to your grandchildren, with mandatory distributions, we should talk, because this is a good time to just generally do the annual once review, and that is a very, very important piece to put in place. The second piece is power of appointment. So I'm married to my wife, Rose. We have three children. All three of them, we hope and pray, will continue to work hard and perform well. But one may marry particularly wealthy. One may choose to work in a community where there's less income. And so, at some point, you know, perish the thought, one could even be hurt. I die and I leave my assets to my wife. She may decide that she needs to be disproportionate among the children. If I leave my assets in trust to her, typically it goes and is divided in three ways. I would recommend, and we'll talk more about that in a minute, that she have family meetings, that there are discussions, and everybody understands where she stands on this, but at least she'll possess the flexibility. That is called the power of appointment. In its ugliest form, it's also called the power of disappointment, because if one of our children decided to be particularly difficult with my wife, maybe because they were married and there was strain in the family, and we pray that never can happen. But if it does, my wife is never bound to say, well, all the money that your father left to me goes in trust, and on my death it goes down to you, she can then appoint it away to the other two children. Again, power of appointment also could be power of disappointment. So keep these two things in mind. It's also a good time when you're looking at your wills to think about changes in your family. And maybe your children have reached an age of maturity. Maybe your guardians have moved away. If you have minor children, maybe some of your executors and trustees are getting older. So these are more personal reasons. And so, what we do is to say, changes in your financial life, changes in the legislative life in the state that you're in and in the federal government level, and then maybe changes in your personal life would compel you to say, let's take a few minutes and look at this. So guardians and trustees, my daughter, my oldest just turned 18, Allie, and so now we will consider her being a representative on our documents. In other instances, maybe one of our family members is not living as close anymore. So once a year review, just for a few minutes, we've had many of you say, listen, I spend so much time reviewing my health, meeting with doctors, reviewing my financial planning and my insurance people. Why aren't I spending at least 1 hour a year with you? You spend an hour and prepare, then spend an hour with me to tell me what I got is worthwhile. So we would love that, and we're organizing that. But what we're doing here is you reach us if you need us. We're giving you the update right now, and then be on the lookout for us because we've been doing that much more consistently as clients have reached back to us. Number five, this is an income tax benefit. As you guys know, we are estate lawyers, but we are now moving into the direction of doing income taxes for our clients because as your estates become more complex, as you have assets in trust, as you're making gifts into foundations, for those very, very unique special opportunities, we're jumping in to consider helping you in these areas, particularly when it's an estate administration. So here are a couple of benefits to consider. If you are one who itemizes your deductions, it may be most tax efficient to accelerate certain payments because you'll have more write-offs. So even for me, I'll pay the rent before the end of the year and get the deduction. I may make certain payments that I can and get the deduction. If you accelerate a January house payment due in January, that gives you an extra month of interest that's valuable there. Prepayment of state, local, and property taxes due early in 2014 can also reduce your client's federal tax bill. Two important pieces here. If you have miscellaneous deductions that exceed 10% or medical deductions that exceed 2% in each instance of your adjusted gross income, consider prepaying. You can take those, by the way, but you can also consider prepaying college tuition if you live in a state where there's no personal income tax that you might consider to make that payment. Okay, be careful. Okay, prepayment is not always the right answer. Many of you are in the category that I'm in, and it's just income; it's not anything else. But alternative minimum tax. So talk to either us or whomever it is that's doing your annual returns. Number six. Are there any major milestones that have passed this year? So number one is do you have someone who's just turned 18? Or do you have a trustee who's just turned 80, that you've appointed that maybe has just turned 80 or maybe even older? Or do you have a child that has just gotten married or moved far away? Have you just had a major economic event in your life that has changed your net worth? Either positively or, God forbid, possibly short-term negatively. Let's talk about the one most glaring one for us. Once your children turn 18, they now are a living, legal, breathing human being. They are tremendously dependent on us, as our daughter Allie is for this time. But in the end here, if she were in an accident and goes to the hospital, we cannot make decisions for her. She's applying to colleges right now. When she gets down there, if we want to check on her medical situation or make sure that she's still registered or even, God forbid, even ask for her grades, The answer very, very clearly is no. And the schools want it this way, and the hospitals want it this way, unless we have legal authority to do that. And so what you need to do is have your child put together a power of attorney, a health care proxy, a living will, and HIPAA, which we're not saying they need to have a will once they turn 18, but what we are saying is that if they're incapacitated, you will have a giant issue of stress before you. So for every one of our clients and every one of you, when we know there is a child in the family that is turning 18, we have a little cake, a little cap on their head and a candle, and then after we sing happy birthday, we're on to signing these documents. I'm overstating the point, but what I want to emphasize here is this is a critical, critical piece. Furthermore, just generally with powers of attorney, they have changed dramatically over this past several years. So while your children are in, you may want to consider also getting your power of attorney updated. Since the laws have changed, when you're submitting it, a power of attorney is a privilege. And at law school, they teach you the difference between a privilege and a right. A right means you can demand it. A privilege means if you demand it, they may spank you and say you don't get it. And so when you submit your privilege document, your power of attorney, to the bank, and they say, it doesn't look new to me, it doesn't have the current form on it, it doesn't have the banking provisions in it, et cetera, they can reject you, okay? And your recourse is to go to court and be named as a guardian in that instance. It is expensive, it's time-consuming. So keep your powers of attorney current and fresh, we say, every 5 to 6, 7 years. It does not mean that if one of you came in here with a 10-year-old power of attorney, even if it wasn't ours, that we wouldn't go in there and go to the mats to defend it for you, but try to help our job and yours be easier. Okay, number 7. Have you made contributions to your family foundation or donated to charity? We have moved into the direction more than ever of focusing on those who are less advantaged than ourselves, focused on family unity, focused on giving to charity. For the second half of my professional career, it is one of the highest priorities for me. One of the biggest reasons why I've gotten into this business is because I watched my own family fight, sadly, for many, many years when I was a young teenager. And I thought that there was great injustice, and I blamed the lawyers, as my parents did. And so now that I'm a lawyer, I'm trying to do everything I can to avoid those instances. And one of the biggest things that we can find is trying to find opportunities where we can be family-centered, where we can do things that are focused on the unity of us all, to put aside our resentments and our envies, to put aside our angers, and to focus on what's most important, which is the family, which overwhelmingly is as it is. But by creating a charity, a charitable investment, or having the family meet to make gifts to charity on an annual basis is a wonderful thing. We recommend incorporating the children. We also have been doing meeting with you all and talking about having family meetings, annual meetings. Now is the time to get your charitable gifts in so you can get your charitable deduction. Very, very, very important. If you have a foundation, you've got to assess at the end of the year what the investments were like. Get your investments out. It may not be working on the same calendar year. You'll have a different year than the calendar year. But getting these this money into charity is an important thing, and the charity is appreciated as well. We're happy to talk more with you about family foundations. We have done a ton of work in this area, and we continue to focus on this. We're not just focused on creating these for people, though, but actually getting involved. Dominic, who we've hired and is instrumental in preparing this report, who sits with me now, has been involved in several charities. I sit on several charitable boards as well. There is a richness in life to know that you can give back, that we all feel, and we're happy that you're doing it as well. Now, more than ever at this time of year, consider it. Okay, we're on to number 8, which talks about charity as well. Once, for those of you who are 70 and a half on this call, this is a great opportunity to know that you have annual withdrawals that you have to make from your retirement plan. up to $100,000 you can take out of your retirement plan. And rather than realizing the gain, you can actually make that gift directly over into a charity. It is a really neat opportunity. So bear with me as what should be the typical way that this is approached, but where the IRS gives us relief. I take $100,000 out of my IRA because now I have to make mandatory withdrawals. I only need $20,000 of it, or I don't need any of it because I've got my other savings, but I have to make these withdrawals. We see this a lot with all the professors and deans and people in academia that we represent, doctors as well. They have large retirement plans. So they have savings separately, but they have to make their annual withdrawal based on their formula. Say it's $100,000. That's $100,000 worth of tax. They now get down $100,000 worth of assets subject to tax. They're down to $70,000 in assets after they've paid the tax, maybe $65,000 or $60,000. And then they say, I want to make a gift to charity. Well, that's great. They're taking a $60,000 check. It goes to charity. They get a deduction for $60,000. But in the end here, was that the most tax-efficient way? Well, the IRS historically said yes. That's what it is. You had to make the withdrawal, you got your deduct, you paid your tax, and now you got this after-tax reduced money, and you give it to charity, and you get a deduction. Today, you can take the full $100,000 out, and you can give it directly to the charity. You don't pay the income tax, you don't get the shrinkage, and the full amount can go to the charity. In the end here, it doesn't mean that you benefit anymore, but what it means is that the charity, instead of getting a $60,000 check, gets a $100,000 check. So, bully for you and all the rest who get this opportunity to do this. You can make this gift up to December 31st if you make your withdrawal. Okay, Gratz and Cuprates. We're down to the last two. We're rounding the clubhouse terms. Gratz and Cuprates are two wonderful strategies where you can give assets away and you're really focused on the growth of the assets as opposed to the notion of giving the full asset away. The one that I want to focus on this call with is the Gratz. So if you had $1 million and you put it into trust for your children, and over a period of 5 years there was significant growth, the argument here is that that growth can pass to your children free of tax without being free of any gift tax or estate tax. It is the third of the trifecta that the Obama administration has gone after. Why? Because grants are really most effective and more so on a graduated basis with the more money you put into them. So if I put $1 million into a trust, let's just say for easy math, I loan my children $1 million and they go out and buy an apartment building. That apartment building they bought in a bad area, and in 5 years from now that apartment building was worth $1 million, but it becomes the next Hoboken and now that building is worth $2 million. So now I say to them 5 years from now, I have to be paid back, you owe me this money. So they pay me back my $1 million, they have to pay me some interest, maybe that's 5%. Actually, the rate is much lower because the Fed set the rate on their website, which is somewhere in the range of 3%. So they pay me back my $1 million plus the 3%. But all the growth from that $1 million to $2 million passes to them other than the interest that they've paid me. Each year, they've got to pay a portion of it back. So it has to be a scheduled payment. It can't be one big shot, number one. Number two, in the most sophisticated, exquisite planning, we can actually front load and have less payments back, smaller ones each year, to have bigger ones paid at the end. And the value of that is that less paid to us means more stays in the trust and more money to compound. They can also make the payment well past the annual date. I think it's 150 days. I don't have it in front of me, but it's a significant amount of days beyond the deadline, so that there's even further time to have the assets inside the graph. The key here is that this is one of the single best strategies to say, particularly for those who are more senior, saying, look, I've got $1 million, I've got $2 million, I've got three. I don't want to give my children or my grandchildren $1 million, but I'm willing to put this into trust and keep my $1 million and get that all back in the next 5 years, but they could get any growth on top of that $1 million. So again, call the graph. Well, keep in mind, you can still do these today because we're inside the castle walls. But once we get into the new year, everything is up for grabs. And retroactive imposition is always a risk. We have seen it very infrequently, but we cannot deny that somewhere along the line, would Obama outlaw the grant? No. His strategies would be to set limits on and create gift tax obligations, depending on how they're created. And it's too much to get into on this call, but to be clear with you, those of you who are considering it may reconsider if the law changes next year, because it will be significantly imposing. So if you want to get the grants done, we recommend to consider them to do before the year end. The second piece is to consider doing CUPRIS. CUPRIS, same strategy. But interestingly enough, when interest rates are low, CUPRIS are not as advantageous. Those are for your summer house, your mountain house, your New York City apartment. You can do a total of three of them. Be mindful that when you do these, that again, the growth of the real estate is where the greatest advantage is here. When interest rates are low, it's not as great a strategy, but given that real estate is still undervalued in certain markets, it's a great opportunity to push the real estate off your balance sheet but continue to live in the property for the next 30 years or 20 years and enjoy having all of that growth take place off your balance sheet. Okay, let's get to the last piece. We're back to a quick income tax issue. How should you consider harvesting capital gains and timing long-term losses? So if you're sitting on some investments that have dropped in value since you've acquired them, now may be a good time before year end to what we call harvest or to realize losses. What's tricky here is that if you phase yourself into a position, meaning that you have 10,000 shares of Google, but you bought them over a series of months, and Google may not be the greatest example because, but if a piece of it went down, what you want to tell your broker is to sell a position that is below your original basis. So if you bought it at, for easy math, this is not what Google trades at, but if you bought a stock at $100 and then you bought another piece at $120 and then you bought another piece at $130 and another at $150, well, and now the stock is at $140, well, what you want to do is tell your broker, I want to realize the loss, so I'm going to only sell the piece which I bought last, which was at $150, realize my loss, get the tax advantage to that, and then in the new year, you have to be careful of what they call the wash principles, which is if you rebuy within 30 days, you've lost that advantage, but you repurchase that position. Certainly, what's more important is that you sell it if you're considering liquidating anyway, get the loss on that piece, and then you could always sell the balance of it in the new year, and now you're in a new tax year and a much longer period of time to pay it off. If you have positions that are over a year long, you now have crossed what we call long-term capital gains treatment. For many years, my wife and I have very closely watched that. Rosemary has always been focused on maximizing tax treatment. I do it on the estate planning side. She does it on the income tax side. And so we always wait for our positions to cross over the anniversary. So be mindful. Many people have lost money doing that because they wait and they wait and they wait to get long-term capital gains treatment, and the treatment, of course, is significantly better even under the new laws than if it was treated as ordinary income. It could be 15% different, but you have to be very careful because once you cross that date, or in your pursuit to wait to that date, you're always at market risk. Do the stocks go down in value? So if you've crossed it and you've always thought about selling once it's gone long-term, then right away address that with your brokers and sell that position, particularly if you think that there is risk that it's going to go down and you only wanted to hold it to long-term capital gains purposes. Year-end is a great time to assess it all.